It's my pleasure now to introduce David Orchard, a fourth-generation Saskatchewan grain farmer, an author, and, of course, a longtime opponent of FTA and NAFTA. He is chair of Citizens Concerned About Free Trade. Over to you, David.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I'd like to thank all of the organizers that worked so hard to put this meeting on. It's a remarkable achievement, considering the virtual blackout of Toronto's media about this meeting. It was all volunteers that did it, and I'd like to thank those who phoned and who phoned and leafleted, and especially those who postered. I saw people out in the pouring rain and in the freezing ice the other day putting up posters. The city was ripping them down just as fast as they were being put up, and the next day they were out putting them out again. And so I'd like to thank all of you who did that to make this meeting possible. Well, it's been 10 years since I spoke in Convocation Hall here in Toronto in the heat of the 1988 election, and it's a pleasure to be back. I've been 12 and a half years in this fight for our country, and some of you might be asking why. When Brian Mulroney started talking about free trade in 1985, I didn't know what it all entailed, and I began to do the most fascinating and most dangerous thing that a Canadian can do. I began to study our history. And I learned that for over 100 years, the United States had tried repeatedly to get a free trade agreement with Canada, and for over 100 years, Canadians had said no. And I learned that for 200 years before that, the states to the south of us had constantly attacked us, invaded us, and attempted to take us over militarily, and Canadians had constantly resisted. So in the few minutes that we have together here tonight, what I'm going to do is three things. I'm going to first touch briefly on that historical background. Then I'm going to go through the crisis that we face today and then talk about coming out the other side of it, because we can come out the other side. This is not a fait accompli. And then, of course, we'll open it up for the questions and the comments that you have from the floor, and we'll attempt to answer them from the front here. In my book, I go through the historical background between Canada and U.S. relations for 400 years. I go through, and I certainly can't go through that tonight, but it's in my book. But just a couple of the high points about the invasions when the Boston States, as they were called then, attacked Canada in 1690 and were driven back by Count Frontenac, the fighting governor of Canada at Quebec City, through the actions of the native people and the French-speaking Canadians and the British. And then, of course, in 1775, when the first foreign policy action of the new United States of America, George Washington sent his troops over the border. They occupied Montreal for 6 months and moved on to attack Quebec City, and again it was an alliance between native people, French-speaking Canadians, and the British that drove the U.S. troops out of Canada. They said that we would become the 14th American colony, but Canadians said no. Then, of course, in 1812, when Thomas Jefferson said the taking of Canada this year would be a mere matter of marching, and troops poured over the border. York was the capital here right at that time, and the American troops, of course, burned it to the ground. But they ran into two of the greatest generals this continent has ever seen. The one was the native leader Tecumseh. The other was the British general Isaac Brock. And both of those men lost their lives in that war, but the Americans were driven out. And it was a pleasure for me to meet Gord Peters in his office. The other day he had me over to his office, and we had a chance to talk a little bit and ask Gord where he was from, and he said, Moravian. And I said, well, that's where Tecumseh was killed. In the battle of 1813, he says, yes, it is. And it was a pleasure to meet Gord and know the roots that he comes from there. But failing in the attempt to take Canada through military means, the U.S. turned to trade means and negotiated their first free trade agreement with the Canadian colonies in 1854. And we had our first free trade agreement that ran from 1854 to 1866. And in 1866, the U.S. canceled the treaty because they felt that the Canadian colonies had gotten so dependent on the U.S. market that they'd be forced to beg for entry into the Republic. And they were threatening, of course, to back that up with troops from their newly finished Civil War. And the leaders in the Canadian colonies, instead of begging for entry into the United States, sat down together and confederated Canada. And over again, when you read those debates, it was the threat from the United States that led them to unify and to create a stronger entity, and that's what led to Confederation in 1867. The United States began to push again for free trade agreements. In 1891, they pushed for a free trade agreement. They poured millions of dollars into the Liberal Party, which advocated it. When John A. Macdonald, the Conservative Prime Minister, realized the strength of the free trade movement, he called the election of 1891, and we had our first raging free trade election in 1891. And John A. Macdonald was 76 years old, but he threw himself body and soul into fighting that. He said free trade with the United States was veiled treason because it meant giving control of our nation to a foreign power. He said if we don't have an economic border, we soon won't have a political border. And what he said 100 years ago is just as true today. He said free trade was sheer insanity, which would have as its inevitable result the annexation of Canada to the United States. He made his last speech just outside of Toronto here, Napanee, in that election, warning Canadians against free trade. He collapsed, but he was not able to make another speech, but he won the election. The results were brought to him on his sick bed, and Canadians had voted against free trade. Again, in 1911, the Conservative Party fought against free trade. Canadians voted with them against free trade in that dramatic free trade election. 1948, the Americans approached the King government, asked if they could have a free trade agreement, but when King saw the final scope of it, he decided to kill the agreement without even making it public. King had lost his seat in the 1911 election on free trade, and he didn't want to end his political career, as he said, by delivering Canada into U.S. control. That brings us up to the more recent go-round, the push for free trade. In the 1970s, the United States was not able to get the kind of power it wanted for its corporations around the world, so it began negotiating through the GATT, the world body. It wasn't able to get the kind of results it wanted, so it began negotiating bilateral agreements with individual countries. It negotiated one with Israel, signed that in 1983, and then with Canada when Brian Mulroney came to power, and in 1987 he signed the largest free trade agreement or economic union agreement in the history of the world. And it's that free trade agreement, of course, that was the basis for NAFTA, and that is the agreement that's now being expanded and consolidated in this MAI. I can't cover the contents of the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement here, of course. Again, I go through it in my book in ordinary language. That's why I wrote it, so people could have a grasp of this. It's written in such complicated legalese. They write it in that kind of jargon so nobody can understand it. But there's a few key provisions. We changed 27 of the federal statutes that govern Canada to bring them into line to what the Americans wanted under the Free Trade Agreement. Canada can never screen or restrict any new U.S. investment coming into Canada. U.S. corporations have been given the rights of Canadian citizenship. It's called national treatment. We have to treat American corporations as if they were Canadian. Canada agreed to consult the U.S. in advance if it ever intended to set up any public program and then to modify the program so that no U.S. business would suffer a loss directly or indirectly from any program set up in Canada. Essentially, the U.S. achieved veto power over future public policy. And in terms of energy, unheard of commitment by one nation to another in terms of energy. We agreed to never charge the Americans more for any good, including all forms of energy, than we charge Canadians. And even if we go short in this country, the United States gets first right to our energy supplies. What it says is that if the United States was taking, for example, so they're taking 60% of our natural gas now, if we have a shortage, which the National Energy Board is predicting, we have roughly 10 to 12 years of reserves in the ground for natural gas, if and when that shortage comes, the United States would still have 60% right to 60% of our natural gas, Canada would have the right to 40%. That's what they signed. Ronald Reagan correctly said the free trade agreement is a turning point in world history. Brian Mulroney had essentially signed over control of the continent to the United States. And in 1988, that election that we fought so hard to get and then campaigned across the country on, the majority of Canadians voted against Brian Mulroney in what he called a referendum on free trade, but their votes were split between the Liberals and the NDP, and he got in under our profoundly undemocratic system and imposed this deal that most Canadians didn't want. During the 1988 election, Mr. Mulroney said, under no circumstances with Mexican goods be coming into Canada under the free trade agreement? This is an exclusive arrangement between Canada and the United States. Not too long after the election, he went to Mexico and he told Mexicans that free trade had been wonderful for Canada and it would be great to bring the Mexicans in, and they began the negotiations for the NAFTA agreement. The NAFTA simply expands the Canada-U.S. free trade deal. We changed 29 more of the federal statutes that govern our country to bring the NAFTA into force. And the key thing which was brought into play, the NAFTA, for the first time in a multilateral free trade agreement, gave foreign corporations the right to sue the Canadian government directly for any law or regulation that causes them loss or damage and is in non-conformity with the NAFTA. And the Ethel case that you heard Elizabeth May talk about comes straight out of the NAFTA agreement. If there was any doubt how Canadians felt in 1988, they removed it in 1993, the most sweeping repudiation of a political party in any Western democracy. The Tories were hurled out of office. The Liberals were elected. The Liberals had been clear about their position on free trade. Under John Turner, they said it was the Sale of Canada Act, and it would make Canada the 51st state of the United States. Jean Chrétien wrote his book, swore unswervingly his opposition to free trade, said that Canada would be clobbered, and that nobody could believe in it who had any faith in the future of Canada. In the Red Book, they said that they would renegotiate both the FTA and NAFTA. And if they couldn't renegotiate, Mr. Chrétien said, you know we'll abrogate. In power, the Liberals capitulated completely, ratified the NAFTA and the FTA without changing a single comma in it, and within 2 years began negotiating secretly in Paris for the MAI agreement that you've heard about here tonight. The MAI extends and consolidates the NAFTA Chapter 11, but with a few key changes. Under the NAFTA and the FTA, Canada can at any time give the United States 6 months' notice and then withdraw without penalty. Under the MAI, there's a 20-year lock-in. The right of foreign corporations to sue the Canadian government is reproduced in the MAI. Now, the domestic corporations and Canadian citizens do not have that right to sue the Canadian government in front of these dispute panels. Only foreign corporations have that right. And in the Ethel case, of course, Ethel appointed their representative. The Canadian government appointed theirs. The two of them were supposed to agree on the third. They couldn't agree, so the World Bank stepped in and appointed the third representative. And the three of those men behind closed doors are going to rule on whether or not Canada can pass a regulation banning MMT. They have no regard to Canadian law, no accountability to Canadian taxpayers. They are dispute panels behind closed doors that cannot be appealed. And now the MAI wants to extend that right to foreign corporations, give that right to foreign corporations to sue the Canadian government from all 29 countries of the OECD. NAFTA already gave it to American and Mexican corporations. There's a section in the MAI called Stand Still and Roll Back. Under standstill, it says that no government can introduce any law or regulation that is in nonconformity with the MAI or NAFTA. Under rollback, it's a commitment to roll back or phase out all of those laws and regulations which are in nonconformity, that's their term, nonconformity with the MAI and NAFTA. Now, in Canada, we still have some restrictions on the foreign ownership of our banks, of our media, of our farmland. We've got the CBC, we've got public education, we've got Medicare, we've got the Canadian Wheat Board. All of those are non-conforming provisions, which if this goes forward as it's worded now, if the rollback section goes forward, we would be committed over time to phase out those provisions. So that's, in a nutshell, what a little synopsis of what the MAI says. Before we extend NAFTA, let's take a look for a minute at what NAFTA's bought us. Mr. Mulroney said NAFTA would bring, and free trade would bring us jobs, jobs, jobs. We all remember the promise. At the time of the free trade agreement, our unemployment rate was roughly equal to the U.S. rate, had been for decades. Our unemployment rate today is double the U.S. rate. And we've seen unprecedented, the longest sustained period of high unemployment since the 1930s. Mr. Mulroney said that free trade would bring us richer social programs because we'd have increased prosperity. There would be no cutting, John Crosby said. What we've seen is this cutting and slashing of every social program across the country. This is a free trade-driven recession. The fallout, the things that we're seeing happen all around us, the devastation, are a direct result of the fallout of the free trade agreement and NAFTA. For example, under our health care system, we're seeing an unprecedented assault on Medicare. We're told we had no money. Really. Medicare was introduced in my province, poverty-stricken Saskatchewan, in 1961. They gave free health care to everyone. Little Cuba, struggling under almost 40 years of low and sometimes high-level warfare from the United States, has introduced free health care for all its people. It's got nothing to do with lack of money. What it has to do with is, under the free trade agreement, we gave American health corporations what's called the right of establishment. That means they have the right to come to Canada and, once here, to be given national treatment. That is, to be treated as if they were Canadian corporations. But there's no market for private hospitals, private clinics, if you've got a well-functioning health care system, a free one. Who's going to pay if you can get it for free? So they're trying to break down and destroy and create chaos in the public system so it opens up that $70 billion market for private for-profit companies from the United States as they're moving in across the country. Stephen Shortell, who's from the Kellogg School of Management in Chicago, the man who's pushing this privatization of our health care, said that he issued a call to increase the pain of remaining with the status quo. That's what they're doing. It's got nothing to do with lack of money. Free trade would increase our prosperity, and we'd have more income in everyone's pocket. Remember the little brochures they sent out to everybody? In fact, we've seen record bankruptcies year after year since the free trade deal's been in place, and wages have fallen year by year. Some of you will have followed the Maple Leaf strike. The other day out in Burlington, they cut their wages 45%. Why did they do that? In the United States, there's three big companies that control the meatpacking industry. They've already taken over our meatpacking industry in Alberta: Cargill Foods, the Iowa Beef Processors, and ConAgra. In the early 1980s, the average wage paid to meatpackers in the United States was $19 an hour. It was mostly unionized. Since then, those big companies have broken the unions entirely throughout the meatpacking industry, and they're bringing in illegal immigrants to run those plants. They use what's called labor brokers. They send them to Latin America and other countries, and they bring in illegal people. They pay these labor brokers $300 apiece for each worker they bring in. Then they set them up in these trailer plants, and they work those factories. They pay them $6 an hour. No benefits. They have the highest injury record in any industry. Fully a third of the workers are injured. They can't say anything, because if they say anything, the Immigration and Naturalization Service is called in. They're simply deported. This is the manager of Iowa Beef Processors plant talking about what they did. They brought in a bunch of Somalis into one of their plants. A few years back, he says, there was a misunderstanding in our plant over rest periods, and there was a Somali strike, says manager Trevino with a chuckle. The first in the U.S. We fired them all. Let me tell you, the word got out on the Somali grapevine fast, and now when they come to work here, they understand what American work standards are. No labor trouble since then. That's what the Canadian companies have to compete with. And that meat, of course, is flowing freely over the border into Canada under free trade. The answer, you know, there's been some talk about boycotting Maple Leaf. Well, you can boycott Maple Leaf, and then we'll be left with just the American corporations. The answer is to get out of NAFTA. That's what we have to do. And it's interesting. We'd have secure access to the largest, richest market in the world, they told us, if we entered free trade. We've had more harassment of our exports since we entered free trade than we had before. Peter Murphy, who was the U.S. trade negotiator, said in 1994, just shortly before he'd passed away, he said, "We didn't enter the free trade agreement over tariffs. The Canadian agreement is a political one to make sure you don't go back to those policies like the national energy policy." We were going to have increased trade, they said. Yes, we've had drastically increased north-south trade and sharply cut the east-west trade in this country. So all of the trade lines are turning north and south. CN and CP are using Chicago as their main hub instead of Toronto and Montreal. All of the trade lines turning north and south. We're seeing our oil and gas going south at record volumes, at rock-bottom prices, and building huge new pipelines to take our dwindling supplies south in the tar sands in Alberta. That they're sending the petroleum south, we're getting a 0% royalty out of that petroleum that's going south. So we're giving away our heritage. We're a cold country. We need those resources, and it's all being shipped south. It would have no effect on our sovereignty, they said. Free trade wouldn't have any effect on our sovereignty. And yet we've seen the Americanization of all aspects of our society. The word globalization for Canada means Americanization, pure and simple. Canadian National Rail, the great rail line that we built in this country, holds our country together, sold for half price. It's now 70% U.S. owned. And CN is now selling off the other parts of their line. They've sold all the rail lines and the Port of Churchill, mind you, in Manitoba, to Omnitrax of Denver for $1. 6,000 Canadian companies have been taken over in the last 10 years under free trade by foreign owners. And now they're pushing for a common currency. Various U.S. leaders are starting to speak out, saying it's time now for Canada and Mexico to adopt the U.S. dollar as the common currency for the free trade zone. So this is what we're seeing, and in foreign policy, what are we seeing? We're seeing Canada sending its warships off to a little third world country, Iraq. What has Iraq ever done to Canada? Oh, they've got weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What's the nation that has more weapons of mass destruction than all the others put together? And who's used them? Was it Iraq that dropped the atomic bomb on anyone? The United States has used chemical weapons from Vietnam to Cuba. So, and in that war in Iraq, the United States dropped 900 tons of depleted uranium in that 1991 war into Iraq, so the people are suffering with the horrendous deformities and the radioactivity across their nation. And so Canada, what do? Instead of sending ships full of medicines and food, we've sent a warship to help the Americans steal the oil resources of Iraq, which is what this is all about. But it would be good for Mexico. Free trade would be good for Mexico, they told us, if we signed into that. Mexico's unemployment rate has doubled under free trade. Their peso is half of what it was. And there's a revolt in Chiapas. The people leading that revolt have said that NAFTA would be a death sentence for the indigenous peoples of Mexico. So what is to be done? There's a cancellation clause in NAFTA and the FTA. At any time we can get out. None of the leaders of any of those countries had any mandate to sign us into it. And the NAFTA is the driving document behind the MAI. How do we get out of it, though? Well, direct action can take us out of these agreements. Mr. Clinton, you would have seen, introduced his fast-track proposal in the United States last fall, and the organizations in the United States fought hard, and he was not able to get his support. Ralph Nader's organizations and others, people deluged those congressmen with letters and phone calls, and Clinton could only get 20% of his own Democrats to vote for it, and so he withdrew the agreement. We had the same experience here in 1988, when we mobilized to get the Senate to block Mulroney and force a general election. Everyone told us the Senate would never do it. We deluged them with phone calls, put out the 1-800 number on open lines. People phoned the Senate, and the Senate blocked the agreement. That was direct citizen action. The same thing can be done today. But globalization is inevitable, they tell us. It's not inevitable at all. Switzerland has voted to stay out of the European Union. Norway voted twice to stay out of the European Union. I had a chance to go to Norway just last fall and see what Norway has achieved. During the 1994 debate in Norway, the Norwegians were told if they didn't enter the European Union, they would become the sick man of Europe. They would lose their standard of living. What's happened to Norway? Norway's got an unemployment rate of 3.5%, the lowest in Europe. It's got no debt, no deficit. 42 weeks of paid maternity leave. They've recently lowered their retirement age from 67 to 64. They've got the richest social programs in the world, and their economy has grown at twice the pace of the European Union. That's what Norway has done by staying out of the European Union. We have an article on the table all about Norway, so it's really worth taking a look at. Japan in 1954 had the same size economy as Canada. And now Japan outproduces, in many ways, the United States of America. How did Japan do it? 5% of our size. They have strict restrictions, and they don't allow foreign owners to come in and take over their economy. And Canada itself is an example. If we look at what Canada did during the Second World War, we doubled the size of our economy. We did all that without borrowing a single cent abroad. We built a system in Canada where we had the mixed system, where we had public competing with private. We had CN competing with CP. We had when we built Petro-Canada in the oil industry. We had CBC competing with the private sector in broadcasting. We built a system that gave us one of the highest standards of living in the world. We have everything we need in this country. We have the skills, the resources, the population, the geography. I'm constantly stunned when you hear people talk about Canada being too small. When I debated John Crosby out in Vancouver on free trade, he said, we have this wizened little market, we're too small. Canada is the second largest nation on the face of the earth, for heaven's sake. And in terms of population, we're larger than most countries in the world, and we are a huge market. The province of Ontario alone buys more from the United States than any other country, including Japan. So we could build an east-west economy in this country that trades back and forth, uses our own resources, and puts people to work. We depend on the United States. They tell us that, oh, but we depend on the United States. In fact, it's our oil, our gas, our timber, our zinc, our minerals, our electricity that are driving the U.S. economy and which we're giving to them. They depend on us, and we're the fools to give it away for nothing. Henri Bourassa, the famous Quebec leader who founded Le Devoir, said that he believed that God wanted Canada to be an independent nation and that we had a duty to make that happen. How can we accomplish that? There's several things we can do. First of all, put heat on the Liberal Party. The Liberals are vulnerable right now. It's not like when Mulroney had a huge majority. Liberals have only a 5-seat majority in the House. They are vulnerable, and they're worried about this opposition that's growing across the country to the NAFTA. And they're guilty as sin. They promised to get us out of these agreements, and now they're expanding them. So they need to be confronted. As a result of public pressure, they've started to hold town hall meetings. So phone your Liberal MP and ask them when their next town hall meeting is, and then go. It's a joy to watch people confront these people, informed, passionate people, confronting the Liberals in these meetings, and the Liberals are feeling the heat. I'll just announce Bill Graham is holding a town hall meeting on April 7th. At York Minster Baptist Church, Yonge north of St. Clair, 7:30 p.m. And Art Eggleton is holding one on March 26th at Calico School. And then there'll be many more. You can phone your MP to find out. There's three provinces that have already come out against the MAI, BC, Prince Edward Island, and the Yukon, and the momentum is growing daily against it. The Reform Party needs to get heat just as well. Of course, in the West, we're asking everybody to go after the Reform Party. They were elected as the opposition. They weren't elected to carry the government line on the MAI, which is what they've been doing. And, of course, the NDP needs to get heat because the NDP has spoken out against MAI, which is good, but they've dropped their demand to withdraw us from NAFTA, and we have to do both. We have to stop the MAI, and we have to get us out of NAFTA. Couple of more things quickly. We have to reclaim our history. It's absolutely crucial that people understand the historical background. You're welcome to buy my book out there. Other books, it's really John Ralston Saul's new book about the illusions of the reflections of a Siamese twin. Excellent look at the history of Canada, saying what an important, the Confederation debates and the whole sense of how what Canada, what we've created here, the model in many ways that we've created here. It's important that we understand that. George Cartier, one of the Confederation leaders of Confederation, said in his famous quote, he said, it is necessary to be anti-Yankee. We can and will build up a northern power. Now, this is not David Orchard saying that. That was George Cartier, who talked about how we must stand, we're against a superpower, and we must keep that border there and build our own policies in this country, and we can do it. Thomas Darcy McGee, the great orator of the Confederation movement, constantly said the same thing. So this is a winnable fight. Just before I get to that, I'm going to mention that we have petitions on the table that everyone can sign, circulate. It's important to do that and sign up the list that's going around. And, of course, our organization and the others, we need help of every kind. We need lawyers, posters, people with computer skills. Every kind of skill is needed in the movement. We have an office, of course, at Young and Bloor here. People can call us at 922-STOP. So Canada doesn't have to go down this road. We have a destiny. We can be a nation on our own. We're interdependent, but we can be a nation that is not simply a lapdog for the United States or helping the United States beat up on the third world. We can be an independent nation that uses our resources and builds an alternative on this continent, a different kind of a country. That's our challenge, and that's what we can do, and we can successfully do it. We've done it in the past, and we can do it in the future. Thank you very much.